Thank you for listening to our Conversations About Change, bringing thoughtful perspectives on technology, society, and change to the net every week since October 2004. Here's this week's show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the 260th Yi10 Tech Community Call on Monday, December 14th, 2009. This is the last call of 2009. That doesn't mean you can order more drinks right now, though. Yi10 means Conversations About Change in Mandarin. I'm Jerry McAuliffe, Yi10's founder. Today I'm in San Francisco. My co-founder, Pip Coburn, is in New York. Every week we take 30 to 35 minutes to discuss tech topics of interest to investors, executives, and tech-savvy folks like you. You can find supporting resources online at yi10.com, yi-tan.com, as well as links to a live chat using Internet Relay Chat. We tweet at the user ID yi10, with no hyphen, and we use the hash code yi10 as well. We also podcast, so you can listen to these conversations when you want to. This is an interactive call, which means we're all live. Please be mindful of this and don't put us on your musical hold. Instead, mute buttons are fine, or hit *6 on your keypad. It's very nice. We have almost no ambient noise today, which is unusual and very welcome. When you want to jump in, the *6 will also uncloak you, and then please say your name each time so we know who's speaking. Today's conversation about change is about the games market. Our guest is Dan Ernst of Hudson Square Research. I apologize again for a little bit of difficulty getting into the call, and I think we have a bunch of people here who are interested in the market. So, Dan, do you just want to take us in and give us your brief on where the market, the part of the market that you're covering, where it stands right now?
Got it. So I put together a little probably unfree form that the E10 calls typically follow, I promise to be hyper brief and with the more fluid conversation jump in. But I've got 7 points. I'm not sure why exactly it's seven, but I came up with 7 points. So first of all, in my opinion, our opinion, we don't think that games on the App Store or Android or the like are ever going to serve as a substitute to at-home console gaming. For a variety of reasons, App Store games are simply never going to give players the immersive experience of, say, a Call of Duty or even a Super Mario Brothers, in our opinion. I think that even if Apple were to come up with a tablet reader with a larger screen, I think that, for a variety of reasons, will continue to hold as a truth. Second point, that said, I do believe App Store games have already taken some share in the handheld market, particularly in the category the industry calls the casual game market. I believe something like a Sudoku or other puzzle games on the iPhone is a perfect substitute for a game like Brain Age and DS. I think that Nintendo's already seen the impact on that relatively small part of their market. Third point, however, I don't believe the iPhone and clones offer a sufficient enough interface for most of the games that are even in the handheld market. Even at, say, one-third the price of the DS or PSP version of, say, EA's FIFA Soccer, I don't think the iPhone version is a substitute for the FIFA version of DS or PSP. So, for instance, kind of controlling players without dedicated buttons, and where the buttons are taking up a third of your screen, I think makes it a lot harder.
You get some interesting new things though. Like I have the X-Plane Flight Simulator on my iPhone, and handling the iPhone a different with the yoke of an aircraft is really quite cool.
Yeah, I agree. One issue there, and flying game that's more casual, it's not going to come up as much, but take a racing game like a Need for Speed or even the kart copy games. When you tilt the screen away from yourself, then you're tilting the screen away from your field of vision. Right? So when you're using, say, the Wii, right, where the screen is fixed, your controller is moving, right, but your screen that you're actually looking at doesn't move away from you. So we could probably dig in, drill into this for a while, but I think there's a lot of control issues on phone games that console games and handheld games don't have that will limit the addressability even with some advances. Mm-hmm. The other point is that, as Summer Redstone, once said, content is king. And so if app developers make compelling content, then I think those app games are going to do very well. But for Nintendo's part, I don't think they have much to fear. Nintendo actually owns some of the most successful character franchises ever, and I put Mickey Mouse in that realm, like Mario, Zelda, and Pokemon. In fiscal year 2009, Nintendo sold 36 million units of Mario-based games. So Mario-based games. So Mario, you know, think of Frasier, right? You know, he's in a bunch of things, right? You know, so Mario is in a lot of different games, 36 million different game, you know, units.
That's in which year?
That was in the year ending March.
Okay.
So they give you some more specifics on numbers like that. So a lot of people in the game industry, even, you know, in the industry, particularly in the States, they will talk about Grand Theft Auto or Halo as being the biggest games ever. Well, GTA 4 sold 13 million units. Halo, under 9 million. So I'm going to give you some Nintendo numbers. Nintendogs, 22 million units. New Super Mario Brothers on the DS, 20 million units. Pokemon Diamond and Pearl, 17. Mario Kart on the DS, 16. Wii Play on the, so on the Wii, 24 million. Wii Fit, 22.5 million. And Mario Kart, 18 million units. The best-selling iPhone game so far, The Sims 3, has sold roughly 900,000 units, taking in about $8 million.
Wow.
6 point, Nintendo stock. So I think that the risk of the iPhone, Microsoft's Atal, Sony's Wand, Facebook, the cycle peaking, I think all these fears, a lot of them are realistic, some of them are unrealistic, are well priced in. The stock is trading at 11 times earnings, and the company has $11 billion in cash, which equals a third of its current market cap. So if we back out the cash and associated interest, it's 8 times earnings. So I think that a lot of the stuff's already been priced in. And finally, I would say that if the App Store does take off as a gaming platform, I think the publishers are going to be more in trouble than anybody else because they're going to have to completely retool their operation. The dollar margin, even if the gross margin is up, the dollar margin on an iPhone game is de minimis compared to a console or a handheld-based game. So I think, you know, companies like EA would have to, you know, retool and restructure again to come up with the size of an organization that would, you know, stomach, you know, probably one-third the dollar margin availability in the market for iPhone games. Those are my thoughts, and happy to, you know, take those any direction.
Sure. Thanks, Dan. That was burst mode. We really appreciate that. And you put a lot of really great thoughts on the table. So rumors of Nintendo's demise appear to be premature.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, they've been around 100 years, so they start with playing cards, you know, and now they sell Pokemon. So, you know, I think they have a pretty deep bench. That, you know, those games, I mean, I think this year they'll sell about 460 million units. That's first and third party of just software. They're actually the largest software publisher in the world for games. They're reasonably decent size. So even if the hardware market were to go away, you know, again, they have some of the most successful franchises.
Mm-hmm.
And those span time and geography, right? Halo does not sell at all, GTA, not at all in Japan, right? Actually, those games don't even sell that well in Europe, right, outside of the UK. These games from Mario and Pokemon, they sell worldwide over.
Interesting. And what's happening to online games like World of Warcraft and stuff like that, and the big multi-user games? Are they growing as they were before? Have they stalled? Where are they headed?
Yeah, I mean, I think to a certain extent they've stalled. The growth of subs at World of Warcraft certainly has slowed. It's been going up, but it's much slower. I think they're at around 11, 12 million subscribers. I mean, I always felt, of course, I felt that back at 4 million subscribers, that the market for massively multiplayer games was more narrow just because of the time commitment to do so. The number of people that could actually dedicate enough time to actually be successful in that environment is relatively limited. They certainly have grown the market, I think, a lot more than people expected. But yeah, I think that market has slowed, not so much because I think of competition from, you know, a game on Facebook, but just because the market size there was always relatively limited.
So it was just a small user base that they were going to get eventually. This was not a game you thought everybody was just going to pick up and start doing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, but small, but I mean, you know, they've got if they were, say, a cable TV customer, cable TV provider, they'd be like the fourth largest in the country. So, I mean, you know, it's more ARPU, but, you know, it's much higher gross margins.
Yep, exactly. And then my last question, and then I'll invite people on the call to ask questions, which is, where do you think this is headed over the next couple of years? Is there somebody who's going to dive in with a new kind of game the way the Wii jumped in a year or two ago? Do you think this market plays out and just keeps playing out with the current trends? Do you see any shifts or any interesting new players?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I could, you know, predict the future, you know, like guys who aren't in the market yet, you know, it is hard. I mean, I think that one thing we're starting to see that, you know, it's almost sort of the topic of this call, is that there are a lot of new gaming platforms out there. We haven't talked about it, and numbers are hard to come by. But if you look at, you know, games like Mafia Wars on Facebook, or even Monopoly on Facebook, there's a whole new platform for gaming that, you know, didn't exist 2-3 years ago. Obviously, the iPhone is a place where people are gaming, and right now it's kind of Wild West, and it all looks like it's augmenting the game industry, and it mm-hmm. probably to a certain extent is. But the other thing is that you could kind of see this turning into a more fragmented market, much in the same way as you saw with network television, with the advent of cable TV and now the internet, right? So, you know, 25 years ago, the big three had 85% of primetime television. Today it's mm-hmm. what, 40%. So you could see the big three, Nintendo, Sony, and Microsoft, having a lower, still being reasonable sized players, but having much lower share of the overall market as the game industry fragments.
Mm-hmm. And then I have one more question for me right now, which is, do you track at all separately Games for Good, people using game technology to do different kinds of things, whether it is to gather donations or to solve problems or to learn things or whatever?
Well, yeah, indirectly, yes and no. I mean, I cover NVIDIA and I cover Sony as well. So, you know, obviously they've been players in using game technology for, you know, distributed computing, and you know, both Sony and NVIDIA from time to time, you know, bang out stats on what, you know, the you know, some of the PS3 scientific research things have done, and mm-hmm. and then NVIDIA's separate but related GPU compute, you know, CPU GPU computing mm-hmm. Platform, something they call, they have a hardware platform on that called Tesla now, but it's still largely in the scientific community and hasn't been that mainstream. So the short answer is kind of no, but I mean, you know, I read the press releases like everybody else when they come out, and they're kind of interesting, but they haven't been investment themes yet.
Yeah, exactly. Let me invite people who are on the call to dive in and ask questions. I think we had a bunch of people who seemed eager to find out something about this market. So go ahead and jump in and say your name, please.
Hey, this is Stefan. I was curious, since most of the Nintendo numbers that were cited were, in fact, Nintendo properties, whether Dan has any numbers around third parties, who is the most successful non-Nintendo property on a DS or on a Wii? You know, same thing for PS3 and same thing for Xbox, I guess. You know, who non-first party is really making money off of this stuff and being successful in this space? And I've got bunches more questions, but that's a good one to start.
Right. The publishers don't break out the units in that. The third-party publishers don't break out the units in sufficient enough granularity to have a hard number. But and I didn't open up my models for the third-party guys, but we could certainly, you know, drill into this offline. But some on the Wii in particular, some of the most successful franchises have been actually Guitar Hero. There's roughly, they call it 15 million Guitar Hero homes worldwide. I'd venture 40-45% of those are Wii based, based on the sales over the last couple of years. So Activision's Guitar Hero, you know, kind of meshed that family gaming at the time when music gaming was taking off. So they've done reasonably well. In a totally different category is actually Capcom's remake of Resident Evil games on the Wii, largely because, as they say, that a lot of guys who've come out on the Wii or the GS have tried to make games that they think, oh, well, Wii game is about family-friendly casual gaming, and I should try to make a game, a cute puzzle or platformer game like a Nintendo game. And they say that was a mistake because you're competing with Nintendo now, right? You're trying to make a game that looks like them. So Resident Evil, there's no other game like Resident Evil available on the Wii. And so if you're looking for, you know, that kind of, you know, horror shooter game, there's only one. It's Capcom's Resident Evil, and they've been pretty successful on just so far ports of their games to the Wii. And then on the PlayStation and Xbox, it's flipped around 70-80% third-party publishers are the leading guys. So, you know, again, Activision has been the most successful probably so far with, you know, they just last year's Call of Duty probably sold 13-15 million copies. This year's has sold about 10 in the first 3 weeks. Not even going anywhere. Wait, the year is not even over yet. And that game tends to sell actually year round. So, you know, that's, you know, and those are only on the Xbox and PS3.
Yeah. Dan, do you see any movement toward consolidation in this industry, any acquisitions, or are there players that are ready to drop out, or are we just going to get a few new players and status quo for a year or so?
Well, we've seen, you know, a fair bit of exit this cycle. You had Acclaim, which was big in, you know, a couple cycles ago, already, you know, go bankrupt 4 or 5 years ago. You know, Midway this year went under. You know, obviously Take-Two's having significant issues. They're not going away, but, you know, because they have some of the more successful independent franchises. But, yeah, there has been consolidation, and there hasn't been a ton of entry to console-based gaming.
I've got a question from Phil Wolf on the IRC, and he says, are advances in smartphone game design finding their way into business or productivity applications? I don't know if that's something you cover, but are people learning new things about design that are finding their way into other apps?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. Yeah, I mean, I think that the iPhone with Pure, and I cover Apple as well, but you know, I haven't thought about it that way, but, you know, clearly iPhone has redefined the concept of, you know, mobile compute and, you know, what you can do with that. And so your ability to, you know, check in on the world, you know, from Salesforce.com being on there to, you know, I've got my Bloomberg on my iPhone, you know. Yes, but interestingly, neither, I don't think, has, you know, dramatically changed their design to fit the iPhone. I think that will happen over time.
Exactly. And they're not really seizing on either location or gestures or whatever else. You know, that is very interesting. And then Nicole's asking, this is very funny because I think you guys are all on the call. You could jump in, but I'll leave them off by our state. So Nicole Lazaro is asking, if the consoles are still the future of games, why did EA choose a closed Pandemic and other studios? Apparently, they just bought them last year for $700 million. And why did they buy Playfish for $450 million to create Facebook games?
No, I'm not implying that console is the sole future of gaming. I'm just saying, you know, the sort of the narrow focus of the call was, you know, does the iPhone, you know, impact that world? And I guess I've postulated that, you know, I don't think it will. It's not a sufficient enough replacement. And therefore, I think that EA's investments in, say, iPhone gaming could be, you know, damaging to their own business. But whether or not Playfish will become IIR positive for them, because it doesn't, to me, look like, although they said they are, that their acquisitions to date have been, you know, positive returns on invested capital. But, you know, Playfish certainly sounds like the right category. Clearly, the matching of people spending time on social platforms and the association with casual-based games offers them a new opportunity to hit people who aren't playing on the consoles, etc. And I think the pandemic failure was a question of strategy, or rather fit. Both Pandemic and BioWare were pretty well known for developing games for other people. And I get the two of them confused. I apologize to the hardcore gamers in the audience, but one of the two of them was best known for being the outsourced developer for most of the Lucas games. They hadn't been known to make their own games. And so they paid $1 million an employee for a company that actually had no track record in creating new IP, and put them to task was creating a bunch of new IP. So they probably bought them for the wrong reason.
Can I jump in, Jerry?
Go ahead, Nicole.
Okay, yeah. So, really at the center of the question here I think we should look at is there is a shift. It's a shift in market, and I'm curious what you think. That there is this trend with games getting more casual, being able to address a much more mass market aesthetic, in a sense of rather than spending 40 hours a week playing World of Warcraft in very long sessions or Call of Duty, there is this opportunity that seems to be taking off with more casual game experiences and social game experiences like the stuff that's happening on Facebook. It's a much bigger market because people will spend, doesn't require so much of a financial investment up front or a investment in time up front, which is time is a finite resource. And I think that that's going to really make dramatic changes on how game companies make money. I don't think they can continue to only milk the hardcore, people that are willing to pay $60 a pop for a game they never played, at retail. And we have the other trend of, computer microization, in a sense, where we have a much more powerful unit that we can carry with us. So console manufacturers are also going to have to go, more deeply into their handheld market. It may not be as immersive experience visually, but once you get people involved, it can be a lot more emotional experience, emotionally, because you're playing with your friends.
Yeah, no, agreed that the Facebook gaming thing is augments the gaming population, but by definition, the casual gamer isn't that dedicated to it, so therefore it's a smaller portion of their discretionary budget, right? So that, if you were to abandon your, efforts on Call of Duty, etc., then, you abandon the guy who's dedicating the largest portion of the discretionary budget.
Yeah, but I gave a talk at DICE, the industry meeting, I guess in 2007, really what we've done, the game industry is perhaps pursued for the past 10 years. They pursue the hardcore gamer. And it's really just that they're really, if you look at a technology adoption curve, that hardcore gamer has the taste and aesthetics of the early adopter. And so what we're seeing in the success, we're just in the beginning of, in terms of the success of these Facebook games and casual games and stuff that's happening on the iPhone, is that's the true mass market for gaming. It's a much smaller investment there, much more of a smaller purchaser. They're not as dedicated, but they're going to be a whole lot more. And so if you're looking at, how many, if you want to have the maximum number of players playing your game, you wouldn't address just the early adopters. The game industry to survive has to jump the chasm. We've got to go for that mass market.
Agreed. And I think in therefore EA strategy with things like Playfish is probably accurate. But, again, you're talking $1 or $2 a game versus 60, right? You got to sell, 30 or 60 times, more in order to,
those numbers do work out.
Yeah, no, agreed. The numbers are bigger, but again, then you're also addressed, that just to assume that the mass audience, every single person who sits in front of a computer is going to want to spend time on game. The other thing is that when most people are sitting in front of a computer is for any kind of period of time is when they're either working or studying, right? And so sort of like what we saw with movies on TV, right? It was like, oh, wow, everyone wants to watch movies on their computer. No, they don't. They only want to watch because it's available there, right, on demand, and they can get anything they want, right? The bigger trend now is to bring that same content back to the television, like what Netflix has done with the Xbox, PlayStation, with, Blu-ray players.
Hey, Dan, it's Pip. Do you think there's any choice here? I mean, I'm also looking at it mathematically at these companies and saying, how is it going to affect the bottom line, the top line, and all that type of stuff. If people are, other than EA, are giving away, and I'll classify $1 or $2 as giving away, if they're giving away apps on the iPhone, and that's a third of the applications out there, or maybe 25% at this point, does it really matter? Is this trend going to happen whether EA or Activision and those folks kind of validate it or not? What's your thought?
Well, no, it's definitely happening. But the only question is from my perspective, to the guys that have an invested business plan around other platforms, right? Is that platform going to go away because this other one exists? And I think the answer is no. I don't think that the $2 soccer game from some guy we'd never heard of before, who enters mm-hmm. the market and believes that this is the best thing since sliced bread, and builds their business with five programmers around a $2 app. I don't think that for the guy that's used to playing FIFA and has had an opportunity to spend time with it, and is a soccer fan, it's going to be a substitute.
Let me make it a little more complex, or I'll throw in some additional aspects to it. One is that the companies EA and Activision, some of the others, were kind of developing games, and certainly the Wii has been a case of, for lack of the right word, democratizing gaming, such that my father-in-law has played, and they have a game station inside of their house. Would it take away from that growth? And then the second question is, what is the difference between what's happening now versus what happened with Engage about 7-8 years ago when Nokia tried to do casual tier 2 gaming and it got just absolutely destroyed? It didn't breathe at all, and now you see basically a phone doing Engage, but it seems to be attractive to people. What's changed or not or what have you?
Let me separate that into two questions. One is Engage, and then the other is, you know, kind of casual gaming and the Wii, right? So there was this massive growth, and most of it was actually, you know, calendar 08, where the unit attach rate on the Wii was abnormal, right? And so people were just buying 5, 6, 7 games because there's all these games available. You know, Jillian Michael Wii Fit instead of just the Wii Fit, and all of a sudden some people were buying, you know, more than they probably need to. A lot of the stuff was crap. And then the other thing is that, by definition, the casual gamer, again, was someone who spends less time on gaming, right, and has a smaller discretionary budget towards it. And so, but there was this huge gold rush, or tulip rush, if you will, you know, towards Wii-based casual games, and it turned out that the consumer of that market was really just there to, it was more experimental for them. It wasn't something that they were dedicated. And I kind of see a similar thing potentially happening on the Facebook gaming. It's like, okay, you know, how much time do I really have to spend on gaming on Facebook or gaming on a social network within even my time spent on Facebook? So I'm just, you know, I don't know if it'll happen or not, but I'm just, you know, hypothesizing there is a potential that the casual gaming rush, you know, on the social platforms will actually prove to be another bubble. And it actually, you know, won't be sustainable because the casual gamer, by definition, is not all that interested in gaming. And so therefore, won't spend much more time.
Dan, let me ask a question. If we look at the measure a little bit differently, and here I don't know the numbers and trends, but if you buy an expensive game, a $60 game, console game, you're going to spend X number of hours, and I don't know what the trend is, 40 to 200 hours or something like that. So your sort of per hour played, the investment sort of goes down. The numbers get smaller. And I think on casual games, because people are willing to buy a bunch of them and have a bunch of them around, and they probably don't play more than one of them very often at all. You know, maybe they just play one and they have six of them on their machine. Couldn't the dollars per hour played actually be much more significant, and then you're opening up a lot more hours in the world? I'm pulling a little bit here from retail, where it took the retail industry a long time to come down to revenue per square foot. And to figure out that was the variable they needed to tweak a lot.
Right. So on the console side, definitely, and that's been a big, you know, push for companies like Activision. They have put a lot of hours in their games, not only because, you know, the games might take 30 hours to play, and so for $60 games costing $2 an hour for entertainment, you know, sort of compare that to, say, going to a movie. But the other thing is that they've augmented it with the online play, right? And so they've people finish the game, and then they go on and they, you know, form teams and go have these, you know what I call water pistol fights, you know, digitally. And they play that all year long, right? And so they get tremendous value out of that game. But what's interesting about those games, the games that are get successfully, they just get enough critical mass of people to play on it, and there aren't many of them, right? And Call of Duty is one, that you don't return the game, right? And so what happens is the games that don't have a good online component and don't have a lot of depth in the original game, so I play through it in 5 or 10 hours, they end up in the used bin at GameStop even before the initial release window. This happened last year with Dead Space. The game was maybe 8 hours or something, 6 hours. And so within the first 2 weeks, games were they was in the used bins already, right? And so that immediately cut off its window on the shelves as soon as it hit the used bins. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it becomes a kind of a self-fulfilling. If you don't invest enough in the game, then it ends up, you know, going back and you cut off, you know, the sales.
And the investment amounts in some of these games are enormous. And the number of years it sometimes takes to come up with a really sophisticated game, you know, GTA 4 or some of these others.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's analogous to the movie industry, right? You know,
exactly.
Before Star Wars, is, you know, the bar was pretty was much lower than it is today, right? You know, Avatar, right? You know, I don't know if I would make that right.
And what's the gross revenues comparison with the movie business for the games business?
Well, at the box office right now, I don't have the number in front of me, but movies, games surpassed the global box office a year and a half ago. I mean, they're roughly similar, but, you know, maybe the games is 5% or something ahead. But what you don't have is the DVD window. And mind you, the DVD window is smaller, right? So yet the one piece of content has two plays at the market in movies, and it just has one play. So it's a little bit unfair because the DVD window historically was 50% of the, you know, of the total movies take. Now that's been changing because people kind of realize you don't need so much, you know.
So it's going down?
Correct, yeah. The DVD window is, the DVD's been shrinking, I think.
Gotcha.
20% or something.
Interesting. One more question for me, and then I'll see if anybody else has a quickie, and then we'll start to go out of call. But has social media changed the way games are marketed substantially? Are you seeing that the old ad model and the big launch model has changed a lot because of recommendations in social media? Is there a big influence, or are you not seeing the effect in the numbers yet?
Well, the big blockbuster games do need some pretty mainstream advertising still. So we haven't really seen much of that. Clearly, something like a game on Playfish, right? You can completely, you know, market it, you know, within the medium that exists. But that's another thing that happened with the connected consoles, is that you can advertise not on television but on the console itself. So I turn the console on and there's a featured game. I can download a demo or a trailer right there, so I can get that ad impression of 2-3 minutes, or even maybe an hour if you do the demo. At virtually zero cost, right? Because right now the consoles, the Sony doesn't charge for that space. They're just sort of happy that you're there, so you get some free advertising when you turn the console on.
Very interesting. Thank you. Anybody else on the call who would like to ask a final question?
Yeah. Hi, Dan. Hi, Jerry. This is Randy Giusto.
Hey, Randy.
Hey there. Yeah, I had a couple comments and a couple questions for you, Dan.
Your volume is really low. Can you speak up?
I had
up
a couple questions and a couple comments for you, Dan.
Yeah, I can hear you. It's a little soppy. I can hear you.
Okay. I had gaming under me at IDC where I was up until earlier this year. I think Nicole's right in saying that there's a shift that's going on between social and casual games, but I also kind of agree with you that, you know, the platform games, the console games, they're not going to give up the cash cow there. But there's a lot of experimentation going on. So I see folks like PopCap, for example, PopCap Games. We did a project for early in the year, and they're primarily online. You know, Bejeweled is one of their biggest games.
Sure.
Primarily online. Did some on the handheld side, but also looking to get into the social side as well. And then you have folks like Turbine with Lord of the Rings, massive, you know, MMOG stuff, Also looking to get into the social part of it. I hear a lot more talk these days about virtual goods and trying to pull the virtual goods platform into the mobile space. So I was wondering what your comments were on that. And the question that Jerry had about are people doing innovative things with gaming that in a non-gaming space. There's actually a company here in Boston called Scavenger. And they're doing geo-gaming. It's run by a 19-year-old wonder kid, Seth Prebosch, who just got some funding from one of the local VC firms here. They're doing geo-gaming where they're running contests, and they've done some work with the Museum of Fine Arts and some other museums around the world and some other retailers where they could use geotagging on an iPhone or an Android device or a BlackBerry and set up a virtual game where with contests, you would go into the contest and maybe you would, they did a thing on retail, I think, in Tucson where they hit a diamond ring somewhere and couples, like there were like 1,000 couples for the weekend that registered on the game, ran around the city of Tucson trying to find this thing. And they're doing innovative things like that, like turning scavenger hunts, online scavenger hunts into games for things like the Museum of Fine Arts, where you would run around and identify artwork and learn more about the artwork and museums and stuff. So that
entertainment taken two levels forward. Sorry, go ahead, Randy.
Yeah, so that's somebody you may want to check out. Again, the name of the company is Scavenger. It's S-C-V-N-G-R. And then, you know, with the rise in Farmville on the social side and stuff like that, I see a lot of PC-based platforms trying to get more into social. And then I was also curious if you've ever heard of a company called Sixth Sense, which is in, Los Altos, and they're looking at next-generation controllers for PC games and then obviously for console games that would immerse you into a 3D environment where you would be fighting people in front of you, behind you, and all around you.
Well, yeah, I mean, taking a couple of those things, comments on them. I mean, things like Scavenger. There was one of those that they did in New York last year. It wasn't that company. It was somebody else who did a similar thing. And in a way that it's almost, you know, it's no longer, I think it would, you know, in DOJ definition of the market, would you call that sort of, you know, a video game, right? It's sort of some sort of interactive, social media, but I'm not sure where you'd, you know, classify that. I'm thinking liability issues, you get hit by a car, I don't know. But but absolutely, people were doing some pretty creative things with the technology, and maybe, you know, people will find those, you know, real-world interactions with people in a entertaining way more compelling than a virtual one. I think intuitively that makes sense on one hand. On the other hand, the concept of video games is the concept of escapism. So, you know, I deal with people all the time and, you know, going and spend an hour on Call of Duty and, you know, shoot some bad guys is, you know, completely different than, you know, what people experience day to day, and so it's escapist, and so you're not dealing with real people, and that's, you know, if you have a social world, then that's additive. If you never exist socially, then it's probably a bad thing. But I don't usually get much into the social aspects of all this, so sort of looking more at the earnings and stock perspective, and, you know, whether or not that's priced in or not. And then on things like Sixth Sense, I mean, you know, absolutely, you know, the control interfaces for a lot of things are happening. There's actually a pretty, I can't remember the name of it, but there's a game out this year from Mattel that controls a little ball with air chutes, and you strap on a thing on your head and it reads your brainwaves. You know, it's a very low tech version of that, but, you know, Mattel's got that technology. So yeah, absolutely, I think people are going to use, you know,
ultimately
newer things. I mean, you know, I when I played games, you know, I'm 41, almost 42. When I played games, when I was 8 and 10, we had, you know, an Atari. You know, it had a stick and one button, right? I looked, you know, the first time I went to Tokyo Game Show in, I guess, 2006 or something, 2005, they handed me one of these PS3 controllers before it was out, and, you know, it's got, 30 buttons on it? I mean, I'm exaggerating, but I had no idea how to use that. So, you know, that's definitely not going to address a wide audience, those buttons.
Mm-hmm.
And on the virtual goods side, I mean, you've seen a lot of the console guys kind of at least experiment in the mobile space with, you know, topping off your account on your iPhone or via your Android device?
Well, no, not yet. I mean, certainly commerce, buying games, buying points, buying additional levels or tracks of music, they're definitely doing that. The pure virtual good that doesn't have a sort of a tangible market value, I haven't seen the mainstream guys do, and I don't know mm-hmm. if they will. I mean, there was tons of stuff on that on, you know, obviously World of Warcraft with the farming guys, but also in things like Second Life, where mm-hmm. you know, there was a pretty vibrant economy, and yeah, I think it's kind of peaked. So again, I would define that as, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but that's probably being a narrow audience, folks that are interested in that, but I'm always surprised.
Thank you. I was just going to add one comment, which is that Susan Wu from Ojai is one of our friends, so I think we should have her on a U-turn call as well and find out more about virtual goods, the virtual goods economy. Go ahead, jump in, whoever that was.
Yeah, hey, Jerry, it's Dave Wisnowski.
Hey, Dave.
Dan, you made a couple references to World of Warcraft peaking out, and I'm with you on the subscriber counts there, but I was wondering if you were generalizing as well beyond World of Warcraft to the MMODs in general. I know there's an awful lot of companies in China that, whether it's virtual goods models, casual games, or MMOGs, are still experiencing rapid growth. So I just wanted to see if your comments were more about World of Warcraft or more about that genre.
Well, so I would separate. So within China, you have a lot of online play because there's not a consoles there. So if you want to play games, you go to the cafes and you buy the time cards. You play but some of those games, or a lot of those, the games that have been growing are necessarily persistent state games. So I think of the MMOG as a, you know, relatively narrow definition, you know, of persistent state that the game continues to play whether you're on there or not, and it, you know, you and it evolves over time. And I, you know, obviously China has a lot of people and a lot of people don't have computers yet, and, you know, that's growing. And so people who have access to computers, clearly there's a different shift there. But, you know, I would probably stick to the point that I think MMOGs have a funny thing. None of the competitors have been able to gain substantial subscriber numbers in persistent state games outside of World of Warcraft to date. I mean, listen, you know, there's probably at some point there'll be someone who topples them, but a lot of guys have tried, and, you know, the problem is it's your classic, you know, network externalities, right? So,
yeah.
Five guys there, it's like crickets in the field.
Sorry, Dan, yeah. So do you think that WoW is sort of a one-time phenomenon that has beneficial cycles toward it, and that other players will be hard-pressed, other companies will be hard-pressed to challenge it?
Yeah, I mean, it just stands to reason that eventually that thing is going to fall, and that people will find something else to do, whether it's an MMOG, they'll find, you know, other types of, you know, interactive entertainment more compelling. I don't know what that one is. Blizzard, for their part, has another non-World of Warcraft game in development. When that comes out, I don't know. They probably have a pretty good chance of, you know, being the next guy to replace World of Warcraft themselves. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's a question mark.
Interesting. We've gone further over our usual call time than usual. So, Ben, I wanted to give you a chance to put any final ideas to the call that you'd like to, and then I'll summarize and take us up.
Right. Well, I think we covered, you know, a lot of topics. I think the area of social gaming, you know, is almost a whole other call, and it's still, you know, a gold rush in there, and there's still evolution in that platform. So we'll, you know, maybe have to revisit that one. But, you know, relative to, you know, the iPhone games, I would just say that so far the numbers, and again, Sims 3, you know, a million, that's big. Everything else after that is a couple hundred thousand units is the biggest. So for paid games, obviously free, it's hard to compete with free, but
mm-hmm.
I can only study business models. so I think that there's been more hype than reality there, but you know, I don't think you know, Apple is done yet. And the other thing is that makes Apple interesting here is that Sony, Nintendo, and Microsoft want to make money off the platform, right? They give the hardware, you know, at a subsidized rate, and then they make money on the, you know, the platform itself. Apple actually, if you believe them, does not want to make money on the platform. They just want to make money on the hardware. So it's kind of hard from a business model perspective to compete with them because they're, you know, they're not charging, you know, me a profit-based fee as a publisher to go on their system. And so that's kind of, over the long haul, probably lucrative. And if eventually they fix Apple TV and I can have buy Apple apps, then maybe we have a different conversation here in, I don't know when that's going to be, but that could be a dynamic that changes things. And then the only thing that we didn't cover in the scenario, I don't think they get a lot of credit for, but all three of the console makers have app stores, if you will, Xbox, PlayStation, and Nintendo. You can, if you're an independent game developer, can publish games on WiiWare, on Xbox Live Arcade, and on the PlayStation Network. And some of the most original games, and I'm not really a gamer, so maybe I'm not the right guy to make this announcement, but some of the most original games I've seen were on the PlayStation Network because Sony's film guys actually had the idea to sign independent developers in the same way that they signed new movie developers like they do for Sony Pictures Classics. So there's a game, for instance, called Flower, which if you've never seen it, is this beautiful game that you just go around and you're a flower and you've got to run through and pollinate other flowers and you're basically just a petal flying through this amazing background. It's a pretty short game, but it's highly creative and completely independent and is sold entirely digitally. And so they understand this dynamic that Apple certainly has done, you know, a fantastic job of getting. So those things do exist on the consoles. They don't get as much conversation about them in the industry.
Really interesting. Yeah, I hadn't heard about Flower at all, and I didn't really know about their app stores at all. So thank you very much. I'm going to have to put those in my brain. So let me recap what we've covered so far. We really covered a lot of ground very, very quickly, and Dan put us on a shotgun start with 7 points about the industry, starting with, look, these games and app stores are not substitutes for other sorts of things. They're not immersive like Call of Duty or Super Mario. Number two, these app games are actually taking some share of the handheld market. These casual games and so forth are actually getting a bit bigger, and they're taking share from things like Brain Age on the Nintendo DS. Number three, there's sort of not enough UI on these handhelds for most of these big games, even at a third of the price. You know, it's not the same as playing FIFA soccer. If you tilt the screen, which is kind of cool for flying, but you're also tilting your screen. So you're making it more difficult for you to see the field of view and what you're doing. It's bad for racing games, for example. Number four, quoting from the Redstone, content is king. Apps with good content should be okay. You know, Nintendo has some of the most successful characters out there, aside from the mouse and a couple other things, but Mario, Zelda, Pokemon, all those things. Year-end March of 2009, Nintendo sold 36 million units of Mario-related stuff. Number five, Grand Theft Auto and Halo have, you know, less than, basically the numbers, less than 9 million sales of Grand Theft Auto or Halo. Grand Theft Auto 4 had 13 million people, for example, sorry. Contrast this with Nintendog at 22 million units, New Super Mario Brothers at 20, Pokemon at 17, Wii Play, Wii Fit at 24 and 22 million, really big numbers coming through. In contrast, on the iPhone, the Sims 3 application, which is the biggest iPhone game that's up for sale, has 900,000 units for a total revenue of 8 million. Number six, Nintendo's stock is pretty good. They're 11 times earnings. They have $11 billion in cash hanging around. And number seven, you know, the dollar margins are pretty terrible in the app stores relative to the consoles. So if app stores are really going to, sales are really going to take off, publishers are going to have to retool to get in there. Nintendo's been around for a long time, almost 100 years, starting with playing cards all the way to Pokemon. And they sold 460 million units total this year. So they're the largest software publisher in the world for games. They're going to be around for a while. And then they've got really global franchises. Halo and Grand Theft Auto don't really sell at all in Japan, sell kind of poorly in Europe, where, you know, Mario and Pokemon are really global franchises. World of Warcraft seems to have peaked. Growth has slowed a little bit, and maybe that's a limited market over time. So there may be some room there. But there's some interesting new platforms, in particular things like games on Facebook, social games, Mafia Wars, Monopoly, and a few others. The iPhone market is still sort of the Wild West. So we're still trying to figure out how to make that work, and it's all augmenting the game industry. It's not really cannibalizing the serious gamers on the other side, the hardcore gamers. I don't want to distinguish between serious and not serious here. So this could be a little bit, in looking into the future, like the big three from TV, which used to have 85% of the viewership, and now we're down to about 40%. So the big three in games are Sony, Nintendo, Microsoft. Maybe they'll wind up with lower share over time. That's about games for good. And there's a few stats, but there's really no way to break them out at this point, and there's no major players who are specifically focused on games for good. Stefan Samoji jumped in and asked about Nintendo, about third parties on the Wii, on the PlayStation, on the Xbox, and you know who's ahead, who's actually making money on these boxes. And Dan said, well, the publishers don't break out the units very well, so it's hard to have hard numbers, but Activision's Guitar Hero is in 15 million homes worldwide. 45% of those sales are probably on the Wii. Capcom's remake of Resident Evil on the Wii is in a unique position because most other developers thought that the Wii was a family-friendly platform, which was kind of a mistake. So they all started competing with Nintendo sort of games, and Resident Evil ended up being pretty unique there. On the Xbox, 70 to 80% of the applications sold are third-party publications, and Activision is in the lead there as well. So I asked about consolidation and industry exits, and there's been some exits in the recent past, last couple of years. Acclaim, Midway, Take-Two is having some issues right now. There'll probably be some, but there's not a big roll-up trend apparently in the industry. Phil Wolf asked online about sort of the user experience in games, if it's being ported into business. And Dan said, great, great question. The iPhone definitely does redefine this notion of a mobile computer, but we haven't seen those things find their way into, for example, the Salesforce and Bloomberg iPhone apps. You can't shake your Bloomberg screen to make it pull up a random stock, for example. Nicole Lazaro asked about, you know, Electronic Arts and why are there changes, and what about the console business? How does that play out? What about things like Playfish and the deal that came through? And Dan said, well, he's not saying that consoles are the only game in town. He's just saying that consoles haven't been knocked out by all this new activity, that Playfish might be the right category here, but there's, you know, some notable failures like Pandemic. There probably was a bad strategy fit where Pandemic was being asked to create new IP, but that was not actually their core skill. Nicole asked about the shift in market games going toward casual and social, that that's a really big mass market. As opposed to playing 40 hours on World of Warcraft or Call of Duty, that casual and social is the true mass market at a lower price. You know, as opposed to paying $60 retail for a game you've actually never tried out. Also, she points out that a lot of these games have a more emotional experience because they're social and they have a different pattern. And then Dan pointed several times back to say, look, the definition of casual games is that the players are not dedicated to the game, that they're casual players. Therefore, they're not as loyal, they're not playing as often, they don't spend as much money. And I think there was a really interesting tension during the call about, you know, the future of casual social games versus the hardcore games and dedicated games. It seems from the call that both are going to progress, but that we should definitely watch the social casual market because it could really explode even further.
Basically, the numbers that less than 9 million sales of Grand Theft Auto or Halo, Grand Theft Auto 4 had 13 million people, for example. Sorry, contrast this with Nintendogs at 22 million units, New Super Mario Brothers at 20, Pokemon at 17, Wii Play, Wii Fit at 24 and 22 million. Really big numbers coming through. In contrast, on the iPhone, the Sims 3 application, which is the biggest iPhone game that's up for sale, has 900,000 units for a total revenue of 8 million. Number six, Nintendo's stock is pretty good. They're 11 times earnings. They have $11 billion in cash hanging around. And number seven, you know, the dollar margins are pretty terrible in the app stores relative to the consoles. So if app stores are really going to, sales are really going to take off, publishers are going to have to retool to get in there. Nintendo's been around for a long time, almost 100 years, starting with playing cards all the way to Pokemon. And they sold 460 million units total this year. So they're the largest software publisher in the world for games. They're going to be around for a while. And then they've got really global franchises. Halo and Grand Theft Auto don't really sell at all in Japan, sell kind of poorly in Europe, where, you know, Mario and Pokemon are really global franchises. World of Warcraft seems to have peaked. Growth has slowed a little bit, and maybe that's a limited market over time, so there may be some room there. There's some interesting new platforms, in particular things like games on Facebook, social games, Mafia Wars, Monopoly, and a few others. The iPhone market is still sort of the Wild West. We're still trying to figure out how to make that work, and it's all augmenting the game industry. It's not really cannibalizing the serious gamers on the other side, the hardcore gamers. I don't want to distinguish between serious and not serious here. So this could be a little bit, in looking into the future, like the big three from TV, which used to have 85% of the viewership, and now we're down to about 40%. So the big three in games are Sony, Nintendo, Microsoft. Maybe they'll wind up with lower share over time. That's about games for good, and there's a few stats, but there's really no way to break them out at this point, and there's no major players who are specifically focused on games for good. Stefan Somogyi jumped in and asked about Nintendo, about third parties on the Wii, on the PlayStation, on the Xbox, and, you know, who's ahead, who's actually making money on these boxes. And Dan said, well, the publishers don't break out the units very well, so it's hard to have hard numbers, but Activision's Guitar Hero is in 15 million homes worldwide. 45% of those sales are probably on the Wii. Capcom's remake of Resident Evil on the Wii is in a unique position because most other developers thought that the Wii was a family-friendly platform, which was kind of a mistake, so they all started competing with Nintendo sort of games, and Resident Evil ended up being pretty unique there. On the Xbox, 70-80% of the applications sold are third-party publications, and Activision is in the lead there as well. So I asked about consolidation and industry exits, and there have been some exits in the recent past, last couple of years. Acclaim, Midway, Take-Two is having some issues right now. So there'll probably be some, but there's not a big roll-up trend apparently in the industry. Phil Wolf asked online about sort of the user experience in games, if it's being ported into business, which Dan said, great, great question. The iPhone definitely does redefine this notion of a mobile computer, but we haven't seen those things find their way into, for example, the Salesforce and Bloomberg iPhone apps. You can't shake your Bloomberg screen to make it pull up a random stock, for example. Nicola Zaro asked about, you know, Electronic Arts and why are there changes, and what about the console business? How does that play out? What about things like Playfish and the deal that came through? And Dan says, well, he's not saying that consoles are the only game in town. He's just saying that consoles haven't been knocked out by all this new activity, that Playfish might be the right category here, but there's, you know, some notable failures like Pandemic. There probably was a bad strategy fit where Pandemic was being asked to create new IP, but that was not actually their core skill. Nicole asked about the shift in market games going toward casual and social, that that's a really big mass market. As opposed to playing 40 hours on World of Warcraft or Call of Duty, that casual and social is the true mass market at a lower price, as opposed to paying $60 retail for a game you've actually never tried out. Also, she points out that a lot of these games have a more emotional experience because they're social and they have a different pattern. And then Dan pointed several times back to say, look, the definition of casual games is that the players are not dedicated to the game, that they're casual players. Therefore, they're not as loyal, they're not playing as often, they don't spend as much money. And I think there was a really interesting tension during the call about, you know, the future of casual social games versus the hardcore games and dedicated games. It seems from the call that both are going to progress, but that we should definitely watch the social casual market because it could really explode even further. We talked a little bit about the games replacing work-study time and movies on the computer and, you know, trying to connect that back to the TV. That's probably good material for a whole different call. Pip asked about choice. You know, if you're giving away apps on the iPhone, and he said that, you know, that $1 or $2 an app is sort of like giving away, you know, does this trend sort of matter? And Dan says, well, the other platforms aren't going away. Your $2 soccer on the iPhone doesn't really kill FIFA soccer on a bigger platform. Pip also asked about democratizing gaming, that, you know, the Wii and other things now have people who never would have bought a game actually buying games and exercising, by the way, something we didn't talk about here, even though we've talked about fitness recently. So, you know, how does this work versus an attempt like Nokia's Engage 7 or 8 years ago that just failed? What has really changed in the market here? And then I also asked Dan about, you know, what if you start thinking about dollars per hour versus, you know, you buy a $60 game but you play it for 200 hours versus you buy multiple casual games and you don't play them all that often and you play one of them. That could change some of the formulations here. But, you know, there's some games that came out where they were an 8 to 10 hour play and that was a little too short and they had no social involvement, no website, no background that made the games more engaging. So within the week, they were actually back in the GameStop shops in the used bin, killing the opening window for some of those games. That was a pretty interesting insight. Versus movies, games just passed the global box office about 1.5 years ago in revenue generation, but there's no DVD window for games. There's no second play. The DVD window used to be 50% of the take for movies, but that's going down. So there's some really interesting openings here for connected consoles where you can actually advertise for free on these consoles. For instance, Sony is not charging for advertising in the PlayStation Kinect, so there's zero cost there, and you can just show up. They're happy to have you there. Randy Giusto jumped in with a lot of good points about gaming. He agreed with Nicole about the shift towards social and casual, and he said that still the platforms are the cash cow. So he mentioned Top Cap games and Bejeweled, Turban and Lord of the Rings, and then also this notion of virtual goods. So, when I think we're going to ask Susan Wu to be on a U10 call pretty soon from OHI, which is all about markets for virtual goods online. He also mentioned Scavenger, a company started by a 19-year-old in Boston, which takes museum. So Sixth Sense is creating next-generation controllers. And Dan said, yep, there's a lot of that going on, but he's worried about the longer-term viability of these games where there might be liability. What if you're hit by a car and you can't just respawn back into the game, right? So there's also interesting new interfaces about Sixth Sense. There's brainwave readers and a few other sorts of things. So we talked about his start with Atari and this notion of topping up goods. Dave Bojanowski talked about can we generalize WoW peaking into some general trend about MMOs? And it seems like persistent state games have found some place that it's hard to assault, so maybe there's a beneficial cycle that keeps them there. Dan talked about social games being a whole other place and maybe a source for a whole new call, but that there's no publishing fees on these new iPhone-oriented smart app platforms as opposed to the old console platforms, so the business model is really quite different. Nick pointed to there are app stores for Wii, for Xbox, and PlayStation. We just don't really know about them. That brings us to the end of Game Apps or Consoles, the 260th and last of the year U10 Tech Community Call held on Monday, December 14th, 2009. Dan, thank you. That was fantastic. And thank you all for joining us. Feel free to add comments and pages on e10.com. And please tell your colleagues to join us again next year on Monday, January 4th, not February 4th, when we'll talk about personal Kanban with Black Belt Jim Benson. I'm Sherry Mikulski. Thanks for a wonderful year, and happy holidays, and until 2010, goodbye.
This podcast is published under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 3.0 license. It was edited and published by Sasha Merkailo. Thanks again for listening.